This is a story about the rise and fall of American civilization, and it takes place in a sprawling city in the southwest United States, what's now called Phoenix, Arizona. We start this story in a shopping mall, where you can find two possible versions of the future for this city. The mall was built recently in a far-flung suburb of Phoenix. One version of the future is on the north end of the mall, at a crowded sports bar called The Gym. It looks like a typical scene in an American bar at first. Folks crowded around tables, drinking beer, eating burgers, and watching American football on TV, where someone has just scored a touchdown. But then you notice that no one here is watching the local team, the Arizona Cardinals. Instead, the customers are watching teams from other parts of the country, because very few people in this bar are actually from here.
We came from California.
San Diego.
Colorado.
From Colorado.
We moved from Oklahoma.
And how long have you lived here?
We moved about 4 years ago.
4 years now?
4.5 years.
4 years.
It's a little strange. All these people moved into their houses at the exact same time and for the exact same reason.
Housing.
Housing costs.
Oh yeah, you can buy this giant house for half the price. And boom, we're here. And it's out in the middle of nowhere.
Or it was out in the middle of nowhere. Until 4 years ago, the sports bar you're in, this mini mall, the stucco houses and the cul-de-sacs that surround it, this whole swath of suburbia known as Queen Creek, where 40,000 people now live, none of this existed. It wasn't even on the map. But now, it's the latest ripple of growth in one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. And even though the housing market has slowed in the last few months, the people at this sports bar can't imagine the growth will ever stop.
We are kind of eating up the desert.
There's going to be nothing but pavement.
It's inevitable.
It's civilization. No matter what, we're going to grow. Every field you see out here sooner or later is going to be in a house or a store.
So this was us.
But a few storefronts down, on the other end of the mini mall from the sports bar, there is a very different version of the future going on. Amy Garish is looking through a window into a barren store.
Does it look a lot different?
Yeah, it used to be filled with, like, that was our back room. It was bright and happy and pool, sunshiny.
Until recently, this was a swimming pool supply shop that Amy and her husband owned.
But as soon as the housing market slowed, it was just like, okay, where did everybody go? Where are you guys? I mean, we literally went from selling thousands of dollars of pool supplies a day to selling $8 worth of pool supplies a day. I mean, it wasn't that we just slowed down. We pretty much came to a halt.
They went bankrupt, and so did a lot of their neighbors.
The Chinese restaurant, Contours Express, the ladies' gym, the title agency, Goober Games, video game buy, sell, and trade store. They're out.
So the people at the sports bar see Phoenix only getting bigger and bigger. And meanwhile, Amy Garish is watching the city recede before her eyes. Who's right? That's what this BBC One Planet documentary will explore. Is Phoenix still rising, but just facing a momentary slowdown? Or is this place that was for so long considered the model for a new kind of American city, perched for a big fall? The funny thing is that the map to the future might actually be buried underneath the city itself.
Hold on to that angle.
I'm watching an archaeologist named Corey Bretternitz unfurl an actual map right now as we stand in the shadow of two intersecting highways. This map is going to show us what this place we're standing in would have been 1,000 years ago.
Essentially, this map extends for about 36 miles east to west, and the big ovals are archaeological sites.
We're standing in the ruins of a settlement known as Pueblo Grande, and it's these ruins that make the troubles facing Phoenix right now harder to dismiss. There's an eerie precedent for massive urban expansion followed by sudden societal collapse lying directly under our feet here.
Here's Pueblo Grande. This is where we're at. That darkened square there is the platform mound.
Corey's map traces the rise and fall of an ancient city. The houses and churches and markets of that city are literally underneath the houses and churches and markets of modern-day Phoenix. In fact, when white immigrants first came to this desert valley in the late 1800s, it was evidence of this crumbling ancient city that convinced them that this might be a good place to settle.
It's named Phoenix after the mythical bird, you know, rising from the ashes, because it was clear that there was some ancient civilization here.
That civilization is known today as the Hohokam, which means disappeared ones in a local indigenous language. The Hohokam lived and farmed this valley for 1,000 years, and at their height in the early 1300s, some 50,000 Hohokam called this place home. It was the largest pre-Columbian city in North America.
We get right up here. If you look sort of right to the south of us over the tops of these trees, you can see sort of some little hummocks or hills out there between here and the highway. There's sort of a brown grassy area. Yeah. Those are actually the banks of prehistoric canals. And the first irrigation canals for the irrigation of Phoenix farms, basically they just cleaned out some of the prehistoric canals. So that's what this is. This is the modern Grand Canal, which follows the pathway of the main prehistoric canal.
The people that we call the Hohokam.
I sat down with Corey's colleague, Todd Bostwick. He's the city archaeologist for Phoenix.
We're expert engineers in moving streams to other locations on the landscape to water their farms. That really is the key reason why the Hohokam were so successful.
Todd tells me that the Hohokam designed and dug by hand with sticks and stone shovels nearly 800 miles of gravity-fed canals. The canals were state-of-the-art for their time, and they siphoned water off the Salt River that runs through here. This is a landlocked desert with little rainfall and punishing heat. But the canals made the desert bloom.
It's estimated that they may have had more than 100,000 acres in production at one time. Corn, beans, squash, cotton, and other desert plants. That's a very sizable amount of farmland for prehistoric people.
It's actually hard to imagine this desert valley having a rich, thriving city here before there were modern conveniences like air conditioning and giant dams to stop up rivers. And yet, I guess we're standing among the ruins of a city that did thrive before all of that. What went wrong?
It's a very interesting intellectual pursuit, because you have 1,000 years of sustainability that presents a model that should be studied and known by anyone concerned with sustainability issues in the desert today, and yet we're not sure exactly what were the causes of their culture collapse.
Are there any mistakes that the Hohokam made that maybe we can try to avert?
Well, that's a difficult question, because in some ways that's a value question. You know, how do you define a mistake? But I will say this. They extended out into literally every valley in all directions for many miles. Like, you know, when you put a pebble in the water, you get these rings that go in all directions. That's pretty much what the Hohokam did. And it looks now to us that they had at least a dozen, maybe as many as 16 different canal systems operating off of the one river. How many systems can you build in the Salt River was a question that the Hohokam were asking themselves, and they kept building them.
The Hohokam's huge and expansive success as a society was likely at least one part of why they ultimately and suddenly failed. The city that had supported a population of 50,000 people,
within a few generations, dropped to maybe a few thousand, if not a few hundred people.
It's not any one factor. It's never really any one factor.
Here's archaeologist Corey Bredernitz again.
It starts sort of snowballing effect. It takes disruption of one thing, you know, leads to another, and then that disrupts the economy, and then you've got the environment that's sort of being disrupted, and it's just gradually it became untenable for the Hohokam to be what the Hohokam had become.
Corey says that's how collapse often happens. It comes when a society is at its peak, but is organized by systems that have no room for error. The Hohokam stretched their resources so thin, but with such skill, that they operated fine in the flush times. But when disaster struck, it was too much for the society to handle. In this case, disaster came in the late 1300s, a stretch of drought interspersed with a quick succession of severe floods. Sifting through the archaeological record, it looks like social strains that were easy to overcome when things had gone smoothly started to rear their heads after the disaster. Overhunting was a problem. People had less big game to eat and resorted to rodent stew.
It was muskrat bone that was charred and looked like it had been used as food. I mean, people don't normally eat muskrats.
Rival religions cropped up. Society got less cohesive. And the theory goes that eventually, things just got so bad that people started leaving in throngs, seeking greener pastures and a new place to start.
We are not only similar to the Hohokam, we are mimicking the Hohokam.
Looking out from an ancient Hohokam ruin at the sprawling cityscape of modern Phoenix, archaeologist Todd Bostwick can't help but wonder.
Now, of course, we've moved beyond by agriculture. We're no longer agricultural society in Phoenix. We're an urban culture. We're a service-oriented culture. So that's the question. You know, what is this new model in the desert, and how, you know, is that going to fit with what we know, what works in the desert?
I'm back in the 21st century now, on the outskirts of Phoenix, in the suburb called Queen Creek, which reaches even farther out than the Hohokam Empire ever did.
Yeah, so some of these might be where they're not going to build all in through here.
Amy Garish, the woman with the bankrupt pool service business, takes me on a tour.
See, they've roped it off.
We turn into a development called Johnson Ranch. It's easy to imagine what this place would look like if it were a ruin.
Explain what it looks like.
It's a street with sidewalks and empty lots.
With the downturn in the economy, the developer pulled out of this place when it was only half finished, and whole blocks of houses just never got built.
I mean, there's whole neighborhoods that could be built right here where they've got the sidewalks in. Looks like they've got cable electricity in. It's all done. It's just ready. It's waiting for families, for houses to be built.
But do you know what kind of shrub this is? There's lots of it around.
This is a tumbleweed.
This is a tumbleweed.
This is a tumbleweed. They roll around the streets. So, yep, we have tumbleweeds.
This neighborhood looks like a ghost town before it was ever a living place. I ask Amy if she ever looks around at these reverse ruins and thinks of the Hohokam that came before her.
Yeah, the Hohokam.
She says she doesn't know much about them, except that back when houses were still going up here, one development nearby had to pause construction because they found Hohokam remains.
Because if you find some kind of artifact, you have to stop development. That's just part of the law here.
We keep going down the road, and Amy points out other strange side effects of the sudden halt in growth here. She slows down as we pass acres of orange groves that farmers stopped cultivating a few years ago to make way for a planned housing development. It never happened. Now, the orange trees are dying and being attacked by cockroaches that are beginning to infest the nearby houses, too. In the bad economy, it's not only housing developments that are half-finished, but the whole infrastructure of this place. County planners and local developers have had to leave the community incomplete.
They're leaving empty lots. They're leaving communities half-built. There's no hospitals, you know. there is one under construction right now. We don't know when it's going to open, but and just a lot of the services that, if you're going to put 40,000 people in the middle of the desert, you know, we need things, you know. So we don't even have a library.
Amy doesn't want to leave this area, but these days it's a hard place to stay. She keeps hoping her community will get finished sometime soon. For example, the space that she points out to me that was supposed to be a shopping mall. The developers got as far as paving the parking lot and putting up streetlights, and then they just stopped.
I wrote them a letter once asking them if they would just finish building it because I spent $30 to go into town on gas to buy things that I could be spending that $30 more in their stores trying to, you know, give them a reason that there's 40,000 of us out here that are all doing the same thing. Just think about 40,000 extra $30, you know, how much more is that in your pockets, guys? Come on, you know, and they're just, nothing happened, no response.
She needs to figure out how to take her $30 and everybody else's $30 and capitalize it and loan it to the developer, because he would build if he could get the money to do it. I mean, the problem is the freeze up in the capital markets.
How bad has it hit? I mean, how many developments have just stopped in this recent turn?
Well, virtually all developments have just stopped.
Grady Gamage makes his living off of Phoenix's growth. He's a lawyer who represents some of the biggest developers in the city, and he's as frustrated as Amy is with the collapsing housing market right now. In fact, he's a self-proclaimed champion of sprawl. When he introduces himself, he boasts
that I've worked on sprawling tracts of subdivisions. I throw that as a gauntlet to people because my point is I resent the fact the word sprawl has been hijacked as an altogether pejorative term.
I've certainly had friends who have come to Phoenix and said, that place is a hellhole. I would never want to live there.
Well, I like it here. I mean, it's a very comfortable place to live. We have the highest percentage of swimming pools of anywhere in the United States. The vast majority of the population lives in single-family detached homes. We live in our backyards for 8 months out of the year. It is spectacular. It's wonderful weather. But having said that, for 4 months out of the year, it is a hellhole. That's absolutely correct. Phoenix is large. It covers a geographically very large area, about 1,200 square miles.
And so the experience, if you're coming into Phoenix, you have a sense of sprawl.
Yeah. I mean, it becomes a kind of mind-numbing experience to drive through the subdivisions of Phoenix. I had a friend who made a documentary that consisted only of driving through neighborhoods in Phoenix and reciting the paint names in a monotone. So it went like Desert Beige, Autumn Harvest, Moenkopi Tan is actually my house. It's Moenkopi, which is a Hopi word, tan. I'm deeply rooted to this place, so I'm allowed to make fun of it, but I like it.
But what do you think about the fact that Phoenix had been growing at a rate of 50,000 new houses a year, and now, as you said, development has almost totally stopped? Does it make you wonder if this is a harbinger of a new collapse, a la the Hohokam? Maybe this time it's sparked by an economic disaster rather than a natural disaster like a flood or a drought, but...
No, I don't think so. The analogy to the Hohokam is an interesting one, but I think we'll be back at high 20s to low 30,000 house a year level, I suspect. And I think we will continue to grow out on the edge as we have historically in the past. Everybody here has investment in a house and investment in this place, and they're unlikely to walk away from those kinds of investments. That makes our society, I think, more resilient. As long as they're air-conditioned, there will still be Phoenix.
Which might not be such a good thing.
There should be a place where we can kind of walk up a little bit and get a little better view.
At least from the point of view of Sandy Barr, as she's standing on an outcropping of rocks in an undeveloped patch of the Sonoran Desert on the outskirts of Phoenix.
You can see here where the development is knocking on the door of the Sonoran Desert. There are so many things you could say. It's just such a metaphor for what's going on here.
Sandy is head of the Phoenix chapter of the Sierra Club, one of the main environmental groups in the U.S., and she's trying to keep some areas of this desert free from subdivisions and shopping centers. She calls herself a cactus hugger, a tougher desert breed of the tree hugger, but cactus inhaler might be more accurate. Sandy likes to come out here when it rains.
Anyway, I'll pour a little bit on here.
She shows me why by pouring some water on the leaves of a bush at our feet. It's covered in small, light green, leathery leaves. It's a creosote bush. She leans down and takes a deep breath.
Oh, I love that smell. It's so clean. It's just like, I don't know how else to describe it, but it's just such a clean little bit of a musky smell, maybe. There is nothing that smells better than the Sonoran Desert, and it's because of the creosote.
It's not just the creosote that Sandy loves. She also loves the saguaro, that iconic cactus with the branching arms, and she loves the jackrabbits and the coyotes and the mountain lions and the owls that live here.
The way the sprawl development is done, they come in, they generally come in with a bulldozer and just blade huge swaths of land, and whatever was there as far as the natural drainage, the natural vegetation, whatever was living there is pretty much gone. The only thing I've seen slow down the bulldozers is a slowdown in the economy.
Sandy hopes the current slow in growth will give groups like hers a chance to catch up, to put more conservation measures in place. She wants a growth boundary to keep the sprawl in check before another housing boom starts and brings with it more people, more pollution, more strain on the water resources and the society here. It's a delicate balance, and one that brings to mind the city that was here before Phoenix.
I think our goal is to not be a civilization that collapses. You know, often you'll hear people say, well, we can support at least, you know, 10 million people in the Phoenix area, or 12, or, you know, the numbers vary. And you think, but, you know, is that sustainable and at what cost? Most people aren't even asking the question, let alone answering it.
This is what we could afford. So it's not that we didn't do a homework. It's that if you don't have the money, you're kind of SOL, you know.
Back in suburban Queen Creek, one of the latest swaths of desert to be turned into houses, Amy Garish understands the compromises she's made moving to the edge of Phoenix. She knows she's contributed to the sprawling metropolis here. She's even noticed fissures in the ground past her neighborhood, where the desert has buckled because too much groundwater had been pumped out from under it. That water is piped into houses like hers.
And that's what happens when the water is no longer in the earth. It kind of caves in.
Amy sees the strains that so many new houses can put on the land and on the residents here. A case in point, last year, after her pool supply business failed, Amy's family couldn't make its mortgage payments anymore. Their house was repossessed.
All the money that came in went towards feeding our children, getting them school supplies. So it was like we couldn't pay our mortgage, and you feel so like a criminal. And you feel so bad. People would leave food on our doorstep because they knew that we might not, you know, eat that day. We might be calling up our friends saying, you know, can we come over for dinner? So, I mean, it was a couple days. I just couldn't get up just because you don't want to face it. It's such a crappy place to be.
Even though Amy lost her house, she's doing everything she can not to leave Phoenix. She's found a new job as a real estate agent. Now she helps people buy foreclosed houses like hers. Amy says she and her husband considered leaving, going back to Massachusetts to live with her family. But instead, they found a rental in Queen Creek, a few subdivisions down from their foreclosed house.
This is the choice that we've made when we decided on where are we going to raise our family. And so here we are, and, you know, we're not easily swayed. My kids started school here, and I would like them to finish it here.
So you're going to take care of it and make it as good as it can be?
Absolutely, yeah. Because the community has absolutely done that for me and you know, in our family's time of need.
We went ahead and moved here, and, you know, it's okay.
And yet, there are people who are already trying to leave this place, walking away from this desert valley, like the Hohokam once did. Back at that sports bar in the shopping center near Amy's house, there are people like this guy, John Getzel, who moved here from California during the housing bubble, when this area still seemed up and coming. But as the economy's turned, so has the neighborhood. He says there's a growing methamphetamine problem, and he just discovered that he lives next door to a place where a murder happened recently. But he can't afford to leave.
You know, this is where we're at. Now we're stuck in this home that we either, one, we just walk away from, and then we screw our credit rating. Or we stick it out and wait for things to turn around.
And what are you leaning towards right now?
Well, try to sell it and get back to California.
Yeah, you're ready to move back.
Yeah, we are.
I'm back here at Pueblo Grande, among the ruins of the heart of the ancient Hohokam city that once covered the valley where Phoenix now sprawls. You can see reconstructed pit houses, the structures where people lived here 1,000 years ago. These are the houses that they abandoned in the late 1300s, when things just got too intolerable here to stay. Archaeologist Todd Bostwick, who I'm standing here with, says we'll never know exactly what the environmental and economic and social dynamics were that set off the sudden collapse of the Hohokam society.
There's a lot of theories about what happened to the Hohokam. I believe the Hohokam were just so dissatisfied with the local problems they had that they decided to move elsewhere. They probably started having fewer children, and they also probably started just leaving.
What we do know about the Hohokam collapse is that they finally grew so big they overreached the carrying capacity of the desert. And while it's tempting to make comparisons between the Hohokam collapse and the direction that modern Phoenix might be headed, Todd Bostwick stops short.
I'm not going to be trapped into making comments about the prediction of the future of the Phoenix area, but I will say this, though. We, as a modern society, have so many options available to us to sustain our lifestyle in the desert. So the question is, are we going to make the right decisions and good decisions? I'm an optimist, and I'm hoping that we do.
How do you think Phoenix is in terms of carrying capacity right now?
I'm not a planner or an economist, so I can't really say. All I can say is I've lived here for 30 years, and wow, there's a lot more people than there used to be. And the streets are more crowded, and, well, that's all I'll say.
So is Phoenix still rising or perched for a fall? Still rising seems to be the answer, at least for now. Despite the current housing slump, Arizona is still the second fastest growing state in the U.S., and more people move to Phoenix each year. But it's worth remembering what rising involves. 700 years ago, the people who lived here rose so high they were not prepared for the crises that ultimately brought them down. People who study the past and the present in Phoenix say that's not how the story has to end this time.